North Idaho News of the Week is brought to you in part by Evergreen Realty, commercial and residential property listings. Online at evergreen-realty.com. Good morning. You've tuned in to North Idaho News of the Week on Friday, September 13th. It's me, Jack Peterson, and I'm here without a co-host today. Chris Bessler is still out of town, but we are joined this morning by Zach Hagedon, the editor of the Sandpoint Reader. Good morning, Zach.
Good morning, Jack.
Thanks for being here. We will start with the rundown of the news on this kind of It looks like clearing weather kind of day. Blue sky up there. Idaho District 1 Seat B representative, state representative Sage Dixon has resigned effective September 1st in kind of the big headline of the week. This was rather unexpected, and we'll be talking more about that in a little bit. Bonner County Emergency Medical Services have moved into a new headquarters on Ontario Street here in Sandpoint, signaling kind of support for the continued existence of Bonner County Emergency Medical Services as an independent operation. The Lake Monterey School District has entered a voluntary resolution agreement with the Department of Education Office for Civil Rights. They will aim to improve participation levels in girls' athletics stemming from a 2021 Title IX complaint that actually cites violations, I think stemming back originally to 2002 was the original complaint, if I followed that story correctly. Over on the other side of the lake, the Forest Service plans changes to the Green Bay campground, popular spot among many people for many years, and it's going to be a little bit different starting in 2025. Speaking of the lake, the lake level will be beginning to draw down. We'll be going down to Winter Pool, but the process will start on Monday, September 23rd, a little bit later than usual this year. And construction is underway, officially. I have seen it with my own eyes at 5th and Pine, and the traffic light is gone from 5th and Church, which I think they had officially started construction last week, but there was still traffic light in place last Friday. There is now none there, and traffic's a little bit different these days. I have found it to be anyway, and that's part of my commute, and I certainly took notice. In old news, we covered this last week, the local option tax being on the ballot in Sandpoint in November. It did pass city council last week, but at the time we recorded this radio show, we hadn't really dug into the full details of that, and time permitting, we'll be talking about what exactly that 1% local option tax is going to entail and what it will be used for if people choose to vote for it on November 5th this year. I think that's right. I think the 5th is the Tuesday. And with that, let's circle back to the big A number one story here for Mr. actually B one, which would be Sage Dixon, who has been for 10 years has been the state representative holding that seat. He chose not to run for re-election in the past year. We've discussed that a little bit on the program, but rather unexpectedly, before the actual end of his term, even he's stepping down and has resigned. First of all, why would any representative out of session as they are now? It seems like the actual duties of a legislator are pretty light. Why would a legislator not be able to, not be able to fulfill the rest of his term?
Well, according to what Representative Dixon told me, mm-hmm. He just felt like it was time to go. Okay. He didn't give specific reasons, though I asked him specifically why he had chosen to resign from his seat ahead of the election and ahead of the official end of his term, which would be in January.
Yeah, in reading your piece on it, which is, I think, the most extensive coverage in local media, the statement that he gives seems to explain better why he chose not to run for re-election,
right,
rather than why he chose to step down.
Yeah, he says there was a number of reasons that he decided to step away from the legislature. And he said it was difficult to describe, but plainly it just felt like the right time to do so. I was more intrigued by the second part of his statement, which was, I've always admired the people whose identity was not wrapped up in an elected position and were able to step away after the appropriate amount of time. So I'm not exactly sure who he's referring to, admiring mm-hmm. people who don't get their identities wrapped up in an elected position. Mm-hmm. I think that, to me, indicates there's a deeper political reason for why he's chosen to do this. I know from having watched the legislature for a long time that the politics have shifted substantially to the right,
mm-hmm.
Which is like a no-duh sort of observation. But I think when Dixon first got into the legislature, he might have been considered among the most far-right members.
Yep.
But, the Overton window shifted, and now I think he has found himself increasingly in the center as the right wing of his own party has moved farther and farther to the right. Yep. And I know that he did not relish his role as the chair of the ethics committee a couple mm-hmm. of years back when he had to preside over the ethics hearings on Representative Priscilla Giddings, former Representative Giddings,
yeah,
in that pretty odious case where she doxed a rape victim,
yeah,
a 19-year-old legislative intern who had been, it was found to be, raped by former Representative Aaron Von Ellinger.
Mm-hmm.
Giddings went ahead and just revealed this person's identity, this 19-year-old's identity, and that brought her up on ethics charges. And this was during a very heated primary era when the former lieutenant governor Janice McGeehan was running for governor against Brad Little, and Giddings was going to run for that lieutenant governor seat. So Dixon, who has never really been much of a fire breather, I wouldn't characterize him as one of these people who pounds the table at the legislature. Mm-hmm. But he found himself sort of in the middle of this inter-party squabble where the people on the far right were outraged, that Giddings was being put through this ordeal of having an ethics hearing.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were the more sort of moderate Republicans who were having to handle this case. And he didn't like that position of being right there in the middle of that.
Yeah.
And I could sense that he was frustrated that that's where the politics in his own party had gotten to.
Mm-hmm.
And in the years since then, I've noticed him sort of receding more and more from the front ranks, even though he was serving a leadership position.
Yeah.
He was the assistant House Majority Leader, which is a powerful job. But I just think he may well, and this is just me speculating, I think he may well just got tired of the inter-party politics, and it's not his style.
Yeah.
And after 10 years, I mean, yeah, sure. It might have been time for him to go. He didn't have a passion for it anymore. He didn't want to deal with the politics. And it sounds like he also got a new job.
Yes, and which is with the state. And I suppose that could be related. I'm not...
Idaho, the Idaho Department of Health and Welfare. We don't know mm-hmm. exactly what his job is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
Outgoing Senator Scott Herndon posted on Facebook that it was going to be something involving running faith-based coordinated programs
mm-hmm.
at the Department of Health and Welfare. We asked Dixon specifically what that meant, and he referred us to the Health and Welfare Department, and they didn't respond by press time. So it is unclear exactly what program or programs he'll be running, but I think that a jump away from the legislature to another state agency also kind of indicates where his politics are these days. I mean, a lot of these more far-right people would never want to work for a state agency.
Yeah.
mm-hmm. So if you want my speculative 2 cents, I think Sage Dixon just got tired of the constant inter-battle, with his own fellow caucus members.
Yeah.
And the other thing, too, this, again, is me speculating, but one of the signature issues that Dixon kind of championed over the years was reining in the Citizens Initiative process.
Yeah.
I think it was... I forget how many years ago it was, but he was really, really gunning for the Citizens Initiative, trying to raise the requirements, trying to, make it more difficult to get these things on the ballot. He was pretty roundly rejected. He chopped up one bill, turned it into four bills, ran those separately. They all failed. So he lost that battle, you know, every time he tried to fight it. And then now I can imagine from his seat looking out at this Proposition 1 initiative, which is going to be on the ballot in November.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think any of these lawmakers want that to happen because it does threaten their positions. So I think there might be some strategy involved there. But it also might be a little bit of just sort of maybe not sour grapes, but sort of resignation that, like, look, this was my issue for a long time. I clearly am not going to be able to fight this. And, you know, it's here to stay, apparently.
Yeah. He's he at least was, and maybe still is, seen as sort of a rising star in the state party, I would say, for at least a while. I mean, it seemed like he was moving, you know.
Well, I think he was pretty well respected overall. I mean, you don't get to be the assistant majority leader without, you know, support.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
the kind of guy you might eventually expect to see on a statewide ballot or something. But
potentially, yeah. But he did have his toe dipped in the sort of far right waters.
Yep.
From time to time. I mean, most notably, he and former District 1A Representative Heather Scott, they both went to the Malheur occupation, the Bundy occupation, the armed occupation of that bird sanctuary in Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
That action by, you know, Heather Scott specifically, although Dixon was also mentioned, came up in a report that the state of Washington House commissioned looking into domestic terrorism, where that report found that the people who involved in that Malheur occupation were, you know, committing acts of domestic terrorism, and they included Heather Scott in there several times.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, Dixon was there too.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he had that part of his career, but I didn't see that really manifesting much after that. So maybe shoring up more support among the moderates was important after that.
Yeah.
I don't really know. I mean, one of the things about Dixon is that he's a very even-keeled kind of guy, but he doesn't communicate overly with the media.
Yeah.
I mean, he's always been very cordial, and we've had a good working relationship over the years, but emails will go unanswered, you know, for a week at least. And then, you know, you don't get a whole lot of detail sometimes, so.
Yeah.
It's really hard to say exactly where his head is.
Yeah. Do you think his new position will put him in Boise, I'm guessing. I guess it's not specifically mentioned, but leading faith-based coordinated programs for the Idaho Department of Health and Welfare.
Right.
Do you think have we seen the last of Sage Dixon on the ballot up here in North Idaho then, you think? Or
my guess would be for the time being. I know there was a lot of scuttlebutt a while back. I mean, you said it was kind of a surprise that he resigned, but I think there were a lot of people sort of in the inside baseball world who kind of saw this coming.
Mm-hmm.
When he decided not to run in the primary, there was a lot of scuttlebutt about him running for county commissioner in Bonner County. So it's pretty clear that he doesn't want to be on a ballot.
Yeah.
And I can imagine that, you know, working at the Health and Welfare Department is probably a pretty good job.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't see much reason for him to want to run for anything local.
Yeah.
And having done the State House for 10 years, I mean, maybe there's a jump to the Senate at some point. But other than that, you know, it's you got to run for Congress or you got to run for governor or something, you know.
Right. He will be replaced by, well, we don't know exactly who he's going to be replaced by, possibly by Cornell Razor, who will be on the ballot.
Right.
And then there are a couple other names submitted to the governor. Any potential political repercussions in November, but, you know, if Cornell is running technically as an independent, does that give him any kind of advantage?
The way it works is when somebody resigns their position ahead of the election or ahead of the end of their term, then the local central committee of the party selects nominees from among their committee members, and then they submit those nominees to the governor, and then the governor selects who's going to fill out the rest of that term.
Yes.
So when the Bonner,
They select those nominees in what may or may not be a ranked choice ballot, depending on whether you...
Well, there's a lot of semantics involved here. That's a whole other conversation, perhaps.
I read that story in last week's paper. It was interesting.
So we'll avoid getting into that quagmire. But the fact of the matter is there's three candidates who've been submitted to the governor. Cornell Razor, Jane Sauter, who ran in the primary against Mark Sauter, of no relation, and Victoria Zeischig, who has been a longtime sort of local Republican activist. So whoever they select will run as a Republican, will be serving as a Republican. So, I mean, I think you might have said he was going to be an independent on the ballot. Anybody?
I probably did, but I meant incumbent.
He will
be running as an incumbent.
So if the governor selects Cornell Razor, which, if you want my betting odds, are very good. that's who he's going to select. I mean, Cornell won the primary. So if and when Cornell becomes the interim District 1B representative, the position for which he's running in November, he would be on the ballot as an incumbent, and he would be up against Democrat Catherine Larson.
Yeah.
And that's, I guess, politically...
It seems somewhat advantageous, but not...
Well, it's always better to be an incumbent on the ballot, because even low-information voters, you know, who have no...
Yeah.
Who haven't been following anything, if they see that that's the person who's already been in the position and they like the letter behind their name, they're going to automatically vote for them. So there's always going to be an advantage strategically to getting somebody on the ballot as an incumbent even before they've won the election. And that's a similar thing that's playing out at the county level with the resignation of Bonner County Commissioner Luke Ahmet. And then the Central Committee is going through the same process with that, although a little more complicated. More complicated by their timing. The Central Committee had met in August to vote for their slate of nominees for Ahmet's position, District 3 County Commissioner. And they'd selected Ron Korn, Tom Cleveland, I'm trying to remember the other names, Tom Cleveland and Kim Peckham to fill that seat. And they were going to send those names to the governor, but they couldn't do it. It was premature because Ahmet's position wasn't technically vacant because his resignation hadn't become effective yet.
Yeah.
And it became effective on September 9th.
Yeah.
So now, on September 17th, the Central Committee will again meet to propose a slate of names to the governor to fill Ahmet's seat. And they haven't said who those nominees are going to be, but you can pretty much bet they're just going to redo what they did last time.
Yeah.
And Korn, of course, won the primary for that commissioner seat. So in all likelihood, if I was going to bet, I would say that he will be selected. And it's the same scenario. He'll be on the ballot as an incumbent county commissioner in November, and he'll be against independent Glenn LaFay.
Time is ticking away. We should move on to I guess briefly let's talk about the EMS, their new headquarters. Where were they before? Do you know where they were? It says in here they were in a former motel.
Yeah. I mean, it was not ideal.
Right.
Their accommodations weren't great. And I think that was part of the push to do this was to consolidate a lot of these services. It's not just EMS in that building either.
Right.
Which should be pointed out. You know, there's been a lot of political chatter about how the EMS built themselves a palace, you know, for $7 million. But it's not just EMS. They're only on the first floor on the north side of the building. There's other county services that are being housed there.
Yeah.
And I think from their perspective, it's very advantageous to have everything consolidated. They have updated facilities. They've got, you know, sort of lock and key for their medical services. There's improved vehicle bays for the emergency vehicles. And, you know, they're not in a motel.
That's right.
Which is, you know, you don't want your emergency medical services operating out of a motel. I mean, this isn't Schitt's Creek, right?
Yeah. Which I think they were... I shouldn't speculate. I think I remember where that was, and I don't think it was very conveniently located either way. I mean, I don't think it's where you would want your central EMS station to be, because it was kind of out of the way,
right?
Compared to where the population centers are. But
having it right there within sort of the county administrative complex, that's obviously going to provide some benefits.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, Chief Lindsay told Sansare Mitchell, or the staff writer who wrote the story, you know, that what it really does is it indicates that the community has thrown in its support for sort of a long-term dedicated EMS service.
Right. As opposed to something being, kind of folded into the fire department or something.
Yeah.
Okay. Green Bay, Publisher Ben Olson wrote this story, a little with some details on what's going to change at Green Bay. That is, of course, the campground over on the other side of Lake Ponderay and on the Sagal Peninsula. It is of great local interest, I would think.
Right.
Because, yeah, I think everybody's been to Green Bay. Everybody
it's,
I know.
It's an iconic,
yeah,
iconic spot on the lake, legendary for parties, mm-hmm. which I think is part of the problem.
Right.
I mean, my read on this is that the place had basically been loved to death.
Yep.
Especially during the pandemic, you know, when we had just hordes of people pouring in from all over and they were trying to get out and about on the lake and on beaches and things. Well, you know, if you ask anybody, like, where do you go on the beach? I mean, Green Bay pops up. And so mm-hmm. being the most well-known and accessible of these places, you know, it got just inundated with people. Plus, there's the traditional party scene. I mean, anybody who ever grew up here has been to a kegger at Green Bay. I mean, it's just, but it was getting trashed. I mean, it was being destroyed. Yeah. So the U.S. Forest Service got a grant, or not a grant, but they got funding from the Great mm-hmm. American Outdoors Act.
Mm-hmm.
And what they're going to do basically is turn it into a dedicated, spiffed up camping facility with an on-site steward, you know, with vault toilets, with better parking, with, you know, all the amenities that you would expect from a fully developed campground. Because it was pretty rustic. I mean, it was not a developed spot, really.
No,
it wasn't like a backwoods site. I mean, there were stuff there, but
yeah, it was kind of semi primitive.
Yeah,
and it was there. Yeah, there were toilets there before.
Not that people always used them.
No, definitely not.
Which was part of the issue.
Yeah, and but they're right. There was no permanent person on site. There was no which
to keep an eye on exactly. how things were being managed and to keep it clean and stuff like that. So that's going to be a big change. Part of the attraction, I think, for a lot of people to go down there and get wild was that they knew no one was watching.
Yeah, so, exactly. Yes. It's pretty far out of the way.
Yeah.
Okay.
But, I mean, we're not going to see this happen. I mean, the completion won't be until spring 2025. And the reason for that was that there was a delay in getting the vault toilets installed.
Mm-hmm.
But then also the weather, you know, hot April and wet May made it difficult for construction. So
yeah,
spring 2025, we will see a new Green Bay 2.0.
Okay. Well, we have a few more minutes left here. Shall we discuss the lake level we mentioned is going down, but not until the 23rd.
I think one thing to note about that lake level story, just pardon me for butting in there.
No, please do.
So The drawdown, like you mentioned earlier at the top of the show, is Monday, September 23rd. That's 4 days later than normal. And part of the reason for that was the issues we had earlier in the season with the slow filling of the lake.
Mm-hmm.
And that had to do with the faulty gate at Albany Falls Dam,
mm-hmm.
which we've been watching pretty closely, you know, when and how they're going to repair that and what it's going to mean for the lake. But looking ahead, the Corps is going to be in the area on Monday, October 7th at the Ponderay Event Center. And they're going to discuss dam operations and the status of the Albany Falls Dam spillway gate repair. So if people are interested in knowing more about that, they are going to have an informational session on it, but not until Monday, October 7th.
Okay. That is the day to go and attend. And it looks like that 4 days delaying it till Monday gets everybody an extra weekend out on the lake, I guess. In our few brief minutes remaining, we mentioned last week, and we have been mentioning that this local option tax was coming and was likely to pass. It did pass at last week's city council meeting. It is a 1% local option tax to be applied on sales within the city of Sandpoint, and will last for 25 years if implemented. It has to pass with a 60%. A majority of voters and this will apply only to Sandpoint residents. Our only Sandpoint residents are able to vote on it.
Right.
The tax, of course, will apply to anybody making purchases in the city. And I guess in the last few minutes here, what more have we learned since that passed? Is there much opposition to it that you can see?
On the council,
let's start with council. Yeah, is there
Council President Deb Rule was the most skeptical of this every time it's come up. and not necessarily skeptical of the idea, but skeptical of how it's been presented by Mayor Jeremy Grimm. She had some problems with that long time span, that 25 year life or sunset or whatever of the tax.
Mm-hmm.
And she also kind of worried that maybe we were getting what she called tunnel vision by applying this 25 years worth of revenue just to sort of street, sidewalk, pathway, alleyway improvements. Mm-hmm. And that in 25 years, you know, we're going to have a lot of things are going to come up.
Yeah.
And maybe we should be putting some of this money elsewhere. But then the counter argument to that was, well, if we make this too broad, people are going to be scared off by it. Making it as specific as possible and targeted as possible would give it a better chance of passing. And I think that, though no one said it, I think my sense is there was a feeling about the last local option tax, which was passed, 1% sales tax, mm-hmm. for the Memorial Field improvements.
Yeah.
And that was billed, you know, as grandstand and, you know, field work.
Yeah.
I think there was a lot of people in the community who felt like there was some serious mission creep on that when they suddenly saw artificial turf.
Yeah.
And I don't think the council wants to repeat any of that. Mm-hmm. So there is definitely a push on making this as specific as it possibly can be. So there is no question whatsoever what the city's going to be using this money for.
Yeah.
And it's going to be a substantial amount. I mean, I think we're looking at least $55 million. And that's, you know, assuming like a 2.5% increase, annual increase in collections. Mm-hmm. We probably will see more, to be honest.
Yeah.
Knowing what I know about, you know, sort of the revenue streams that come in here, especially in the summertime.
Mm-hmm.
And like you mentioned, you know, anybody who makes sales in the town, other than sort of like housing sales, I mean, this is like basically retail sales and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And we have a ton of people who come to town during the summer.
Mm-hmm.
So the visitors, the newcomers, whatever, they'll be bearing a big portion of this too.
Yeah.
But as far as going back to the opposition part of that, you know, Councilor Kyle Schreiber, I think he was pretty articulate about cautioning against overspending, kind of like when somebody wins the lottery, you know, like they go out and they buy a boat and they buy, you know, an RV and they buy this and they buy that. And then all of a sudden, you know, these things start to break down and they don't have any more money to fix them.
Yeah.
And so then suddenly they're selling them on Facebook yard sale.
Yeah.
So he said, you know, the city shouldn't get into that mentality where we get this money, we get this dedicated revenue stream, and then we start just like going whole hog on everything.
Yeah.
And then build out this infrastructure that in 25 years is going to be falling apart because that's about as long as streets last.
Yeah.
And then we'll be left with this big built out infrastructure system and no money to put toward it. Because one of the wrinkles here is that as a resort city with a population of under 10,000 as of the 2020 census, we are allowed under Idaho law to use the local option tax. If our population goes above 10,000, which I can almost promise you it already has, but won't be official until 2030 with the next census, we won't have that tool available to us.
Yeah.
So that's part of the rationale for making this a 25-year sunset, is that we lock it in now, assuming we're going to be above 10,000 in 2030, lose this tool, but then we've already kind of built it in.
Yeah. I know. Yeah. Mayor Grimm has been on this radio station kind of articulating the need for increased revenue to fund street repair that, you know, basically where most people, I think, would agree that the city streets in Sandpoint are not up to par.
Right.
And, and there's... Currently, there is just no money available to improve them beyond bare, you know, the maintenance level that they currently have, which is, to a lot of people's minds, I would say, insufficient.
Right.
So explained, I guess, the reasoning for it. I guess there is also, I suppose people could oppose it for any number of reasons.
Well, it's a tax.
Is a tax.
That's reason enough for a lot of people to oppose it no matter what.
Yeah. Anyway, you can go back on our website if you'd like to hear him in his own words explain it. I know the reader has done an interview with Grimm as well, talking about, well, you've interviewed him many times, but this has come up in conversation. That will be on the ballot in November. Speaking of the ballot in November, there are local candidates on the ballot. And I believe it is on the 15th of October. There's a, look right there, out at Sandpoint High School. There's a forum hosted by the reader in this radio station, and I don't know if there are any other entities involved, but You can listen in on the 15th. I think there's also one on Wednesday the 2nd, hosted by the Bee, that we will probably be broadcasting. So October is next month, and that is that's going to be a busy one in the election. The busiest.
Right.
Of the, yes.
And we're going to have full details on that forum in next week's paper.
Okay, good. Well, we'll look forward to that. What else is in next week's paper?
Oh, well. I thought we were out of time, but okay.
Okay.
I can...
Can you tease anything before we go?
I can tease, well, the forum, for one thing.
Sure.
I went and did a tour with Sansare Mitchell and Jason Welker and Maeve Nevins-Lavtar from the city and a representative from the construction team of James E. Russell Sports Center. I actually got to walk through the building, got to check the whole thing out. So
all right.
I'm planning to do a broader look at where we are with that facility and the process of building it and sort of what's gone into it.
Okay.
Hoping to pull that together for next week. I can't promise it, but that is definitely on my agenda, is a deeper look inside the James E. Russell Sports Facility.
Photographs, too?
Photographs, too.
All right. Now we're talking. That's going to do it. Zach Hagedorn is the editor of the Sandpoint Reader, available on newsstands every Thursday, and you can usually continue to pick them up throughout the week, but sometimes they go fast.
Sometimes they do.
Sometimes you can't find them after a couple of days. Coming up next, it's going to be Otto's Eclectic Mix. Tonight at the Panetta Theater, we look forward to seeing those of you who got tickets to the big fundraiser event for this radio station, an evening with Viggo Mortensen and a showing of The Dead Don't Hurt. That is tonight, as a reminder. Don't forget to show up on time. You know, don't want to miss that. And we also have another showing tomorrow night, too. I think that's going to do it. This is Panhandle Community Radio. This has been North Idaho News of the Week. Thanks again, Zach.
Thank you.